Hello, Culture Sex Relationships. I'm Justin, who I'm the person who does most of the speaking around here, but hopefully speaking with you all and through you all and in response to you all. I hope you're doing well. I wonder what you're doing right now. Right here, it's Sunday at Justin Towers, and maybe I've got a tiniest bit of a hangover. That's why I'm sounding a little bit croaky. I've just had my breakfast, my yogurts, my fruits, peanut butter, nuts, seeds, and my kefirs, and I'm raring to go. Had my coffee. And I thought, do a little podcast. So, it's another Ask Justin, which is great. I love the Ask Justins. They make it really easy. If you haven't asked Justin, if you have a query, a problem, a scenario you'd like me to talk through with everyone on the podcast, then do send them in either directly to me via email, culturesexrelationships@gmail.com, culturesexrelationships@gmail.com, or via the anonymous Google Forms. There's a question bit there where you can ask me a question or just suggest topics for the show if you don't want to reveal your email address. And as ever, thank you to my patrons for supporting me to make the show. Patrons also get bits of extra content as well. I'm working on a zine, which I might mention later because it's relevant to today's episode. So there are pages of a zine which are going up, not frequently, but when I get a chance to do them. There are also some back episodes of shows that aren't available on the main feed. And also a reading I've been doing from Enjoy Sex, How, When, and If You Want To, the book I wrote with Meg John Barker, with additional side notes from me, because we did write that some time ago now, and there was some kind of, there's a bit of marginalia from me to kind of update it and some reflections on it. So, that's all stuff you could check out at the Patreon, patreon.com/culturesexrelationships, just a quid a month. Then that helps me to make the show, and also encourages me to make the show. I say make the show. We're all making the show. I'm just the one pressing the record and uploading the files. Anyway, so here's the question. Hey, good afternoon. I have a question that could easily be summarised as how to deal with FOMO in a non-monogamous/poly/RA, that means relationship anarchist, relationships, brackets FOMO, fear of missing out. And to give a bit more information, when I was in a polyamorous relationship for over a year, I noticed that I sometimes struggle with complicated feelings around missing out on brackets important events, activities that my then partner would attend with their other partners. They seem to also have a hard time dealing with their partner's feeling of FOMO and dividing activities. It made me think of how to handle things myself in the future if I would have multiple partners. I think there's a part that has to do with unpacking heteronormative scripts, so bracket, het, close bracket, normative scripts, around dating, but I haven't managed to detangle everything myself and would love to hear your take on it. I don't think it matters, but I'm a queer non-binary person, smiley face. What happens to this question? Thanks for taking the time to read it. Well, first of all, what a wonderful question. Such a joy reading this question. Friendly, reflexive, vulnerable, but with a sense of kind of padding and packaging around it, which was like a kind of an understanding of what it is that you're feeling tricky about, and what a nice kind of way to end off as well. Whatever happens to this question, thanks for taking the time to read it. Well, thank you for taking the time to send it, and I hope you'll enjoy me overthinking it and talking about a 17th century philosopher and rambling on. First of all, I think you talk about you haven't managed to detangle everything yourself. Well, you know, as I've been saying on the podcast lately, everything is an entanglement. To quote Karen Barad, the feminist quantum physicist philosopher, existence isn't an individual affair. We're all entangled up with other people. So what it is to be living and conscious in the world is to be entangled. In fact, we only become conscious and living in the world by being entangled in relationship to nature, culture, relationships, however we kind of frame it. So everything is an entanglement. So disentangling can be very, very tricky. But I think that mapping the entanglement, kind of figuring out where we're entangled, figuring out what that looks like, looking towards where the ends of our entanglements might be, and redrawing those entanglements. So thinking of it as a squiggly line and then redrawing that squiggly line to see where else it might take us and how that might look in relation to everything, everyone else, is the work. And I think that's when we think of ourselves as being entangled in that way, but just redrawing those entanglements, I think it makes life a lot easier because we can't cut ourselves off and separate ourselves off from the world in kind of neat kind of tessellations like that. I think that it's better just to kind of think of ourselves as messy. And it's kind of interesting, actually, because that kind of brings me to something I might talk about in a bit, but it sounds like your experience of your year of a polyamorous relationship, perhaps that maybe there's something in your question that I'm reading into, and maybe I shouldn't be doing this because I'm trying to tell you what something is rather than what something might be, but what we might do with something. But if you've experienced, if in that relationship you experienced this kind of separation, these kind of like tiles which kind of lie next to each other and kind of neatly, but there is always a dividing line around a kind of a central kind of tile, and then those tiles kind of, you know, are kind of neatly kind of arranged around the central tile and the other tiles are separated off. Perhaps that's why it didn't kind of work out and why you're experiencing this kind of FOMO. And maybe that just might be, if we approach relationships as an entanglement or a set of entanglements rather than kind of neat kind of tessellations, then I think that might be a great clue moving forward, a really great tool and useful way of thinking. Well, I think so anyway. But the other thing I just wanted to also just bring up just to begin with is, you know, you're saying that your partner was having a hard time and that you struggled with complicated feelings. I think it's just really useful just for us all just to breathe and remember whatever kind of relationship we're doing, they can all be hard. It's tricky. They can be very, very difficult and full of tricky feelings. Feeling a feeling by ourselves can be hard enough, but feeling a feeling in relation to somebody else, like, and having somebody else's feeling, is tricky, particularly when everything is an entanglement already. So it's even can be hard to figure out what our feelings are, which I've talked about on a previous episode. And it's tough. It can be tough. So I think, you know, whilst there are tremendous possibilities for joy in relationships, I think we also have to acknowledge that there's tremendous possibility for sadness. But the great news is that, you know, we're allowed to organise our intimate lives, our relationships, our feelings for somebody rather than just feelings, you know, we're able to organise, create containers, create timetables, create spaces, have kind of different ways of communicating, different ways of thinking about what's important to us, different kinds of ways of, you know, even thinking about volume levels and how we increase or decrease various aspects of our relationships, the different ways that we might do things, as well as the actual things we may or may not want to do with somebody, as well as thinking about the many different ways in which those things can be done, is really useful. So again, another plug here for the Make Your Own Relationship User Guide that Meg John and I wrote. It's over at megjohnandjustin.com/culturesex. No, it's not. megjohnandjustin.com/publications. There is a link to the zines in the link.tree/culturesexrel. It's also in the show notes for the episode. Anyway, so there are lots of different ways. There are almost like infinite numbers of ways of how we organize and operate and produce and make relationships happen. And you're already aware of this because you're already using terms like RA, relationship anarchy, non-monogamous poly. You understand that there are different kinds of ways of thinking about these things. In a previous episode, I've talked about kind of abundant relating or post-capitalist relating, which might be an episode that you might want to check out. But anyway, they're hard. They can be hard, but also they can be made easier by doing things in different ways. And by drawing this line of entanglement, by making a line move in a different direction, incorporate different parts of our relational self, by incorporating different parts of our entanglement and redrawing them to map them in a different direction. So next, let's think about the fear of missing out. Let's think about the term fear of missing out. And let's explore that. It's a term I've heard a lot, and you know, I've used it a lot, but I never really got the chance to really think about this or interrogate it until your question came in. So thank you for asking me about this, because it's given me the kind of the space and the prompt to think about this as an idea. So let's really break it down. So a fear of missing out. What is a fear? What are we fearing? So fear isn't like an emotion. Feeling is like a feeling state. I don't really like saying what things are, but let's say that a feeling is a feeling. A fear is a feeling state and not an emotional state. And I've written about this, and I've got a bit about this in my zines that I'm making over at the Patreon about this. But let's say that being conscious, being a conscious human, involves being how our body's affected by things, which is a kind of like a feeling state. So what happens in our body when we're being affected by the world? Which is where fear comes in. And then there might be like an emotional state, which is where a kind of a more conscious kind of becoming related to like the feeling. And then there are things that we might think, which might involve, you know, creative thinking or rational thinking or reflexive. So being like thinking about our previous lives or thinking about what's going on for us or thinking about our values, what's important to us, that ethical situation. And then the things that we might do. So the things that we might do as a result of all of those things that then has the opportunity to affect others. Okay, to affect ourselves, to affect our own bodies, but also to affect the outside world, which then will also affect us, because we're always in relation to the outside world. Well, there is no inside and outside, but we're always in. Let's further challenge the binary of insides and outsides. I'm going way too complicated. Okay, so when we perform an action, when we do something, that affects other people and other things and the world generally, which also affects us. Those things both happen at the same time or in relation to each other. God, come on, Justin. Okay, so let's say like a fear is more like a feeling. It's a less conscious. It's less conscious than an emotion. And we feel fear in our bodies. So when you're feeling fear, what do you feel? You know, what happens in your body? How are you? What are the things that actually happen in your body? You know, like biochemically, what's actually happening there? You know, for a lot of people, fear might be a kind of a shock. So they might kind of their shoulders might tighten. They might kind of react by tensing up various muscles in their body. There might be a sharp intake of breath, their breathing might accelerate, the heart rate might just jump really quickly, they might get more kind of tunnel vision, the hearing kind of changes, and we might talk about kind of the 4 Fs, something that I used to talk about with Meg John. The 4 Fs are, you know, fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. That's also kind of disassociating as well, which can be like what people call a trauma response, or we could also just call a response to something which kind of triggers us, like anything might trigger us. So fear is this kind of thing which is, we can't really say it is an emotion. It's just like how our body's affected. But what might that feeling kind of lead to? If we think of, you know, some of the potential emotions that that feeling might lead to, it might lead to sad or joy, even strangely. You know, we can be surprised by something which can sometimes feel like fear, but that might lead to quite a joyful kind of emotion. Or it might lead to worry, or it might lead to anger, or it might lead to feeling like ashamed or disgust. So I think it's kind of useful to think about these things as being, you know, being a fear as being a kind of almost like a, not a lower order, but just kind of like an earlier kind of conscious state of something. And then to think, okay, well, this might at some point lead to an emotion. And we can make use of a feeling by helping us to figure out, okay, what's this emotional state potentially leading to? What might be something that that we might be leading to? And so if we can start to think about, instead of thinking about the fear of missing out, we might think about the joy of missing out or the sadness of missing out. Okay, so that might be a more accurate way of describing FOMO. Maybe it's SOMO, like a feeling sadness of missing out. Okay, but just to go back a stage, often, and Meg John's written about this in their How to Feel Your Feelings zine, I think that's what it's called, which is available at their website, rewritingtherules.com. But, you know, when we, if we fear a feeling, then that's very different when we fear an emotion, that's very different to feeling an emotion. Like actually understanding that we're feeling an emotion and going through feeling an emotion can be very useful. And again, me and Meg John talks about this, but also I've written about like the core feelings over at Bish as well. So, you know, there is use in feeling sad. There is use in feeling joy. There is use in feeling shame. There is use in feeling worried. And there is use in feeling anger. They all do things. They all have the possibility to do things. So I think the sooner we become conscious that a feeling has now become an emotion and that we can feel the emotion, sorry, I'm using lots of contradictory words, that we can be in an emotional state and understand we're in an emotional state, then the more quickly we can start to become make use of those and to think of what that might actually do, how we might think about that and what kind of we might do about that and how then we can affect the world as a result of that. Okay, so rather than kind of getting stuck in the fear space, maybe it's a useful opportunity to think about, okay, well, what if we're just moving through through feelings, emotions, thoughts and actions and how that affects us and how we affect everything around us, including us. So I hope I'm making sense so far. So let's say that you're experiencing a sadness of missing out. Right, well, sadness is really useful because sadness is the loss emotion, isn't it? Let's say that sadness is the loss emotion. That feeling of, I don't have this thing anymore. Jeanette Winterson in her really great book, Written on the Body, there's a constant refrain in that book which says, why is the measure of love loss? And so that feeling of, you know, not having something, of loss, that real sadness in that sense can be very useful because it can tell us, well, I am actually genuinely missing out on something here. And this is something that I really feel like I actually need. And so by doing that, we can then think, well, okay, well, I know how to be sad. If I'm feeling sad, I know that it is emotion that that I can make use of and it will pass. And at some point, I'll feel something else. Sometimes emotions can feel very kind of unbearable. So sometimes we need to kind of distract ourselves from emotions. Sophie at Love Uncommon writes about this really well, that, you know, when we're feeling an emotion, we don't have to feel the emotion all the way through in one go. We can kind of turn it down or take a break or understand when, you know, I think it was in their Feeling Thermometers blog, I think. I'll try and find it, put it in the show notes if I remember. But I think that's a really useful kind of way of looking at it, that, you know, when we're feeling a sad of missing out, or sad at missing out, SOMO, no, SOMO is better. SOMO, we're going with SOMO, folks. You know, there are ways that we can help ourselves through these emotions that are difficult. But also, it might give you really useful info. And actually, if in your last relationship, dear listener, that you, dear listener who wrote in, if you were feeling sad of missing out, maybe that might have told you that there was something about the relationship that needed to change. So maybe that was an opportunity that could have given you some kind of some intelligence, some new facts, some new ways of thinking that told you, okay, this isn't working out. We're going to have to reorganize this. We're going to have to reorient it. We're going to have to redraw our entanglement a bit, because I don't like this feeling like I'm over here. And if your partner was doing this, this person remains over here, this person remains over here, and that wasn't working for you and you wanted something else, then maybe it was you needed to have a different way of doing it, or you needed to have a relationship with different person or people or with yourself. So I think that's potentially, you know, a more useful way of looking at it. And really, another way of thinking about sadness is through Spinoza, the aforementioned 17th century philosopher. And in Spinoza's book, The Ethics, he talked about two key emotional states. So joy and sadness. Joy is having the increased capacity to act, and sadness is having the decreased capacity to act. Now, this means talking about joy and sadness in slightly different kind of ways to what I've just been talking about. And here, confusingly, I'm going to argue that feeling sad, like the ability to go through the emotion, to go through from the feeling stage to the emotion stage, to think through the doing stage, and using feelings as using emotions as part of that to inform you and to help you to kind of redraw your entanglement, is actually increasing your capacity to act. So I think that if we can actually feel pure sadness rather than a fear of sadness, and use it to help us and to help us to think about what it is that what this means for us and how we need to change things or look after ourselves or do something else or think about the ways of relating differently, then we're having an increased capacity to act. So I think that's also potentially an interesting way of thinking about this. But really, just to kind of step out of the thinking of sadness as an emotion, instead of thinking about the decreased capacity to act. If you're in a relationship, any kind of relationship, where you're feeling like you have a decreased capacity to act, particularly if you're doing, well, in any kind of relationship, actually, if you're feeling like you can't, or you're restricted, or you're not free, or that it's a zero sum game, that if an other in your relationship is having something, which means you can't have something, then we would argue that that's probably not a very good relationship. We would argue that if there's a relationship where I'm arguing that if you're in a relationship where you regularly have a decreased capacity to act, and you're not feeling that kind of freedom, whether we're talking about monogamous romantic relationships or friendships or family relationships or your relationship with yourself, any of the relationships that we kind of talk about, and again in the zine, in the Make Your Own Relationship User Guide zine, we talk about, you know, the seven different kinds of love that the ancient Greeks talked about, and, you know, anyway, if we're in a zero-sum game where one person is up and one person is down, and that goes for two ways. So let's say you were missing out, you had the sadness of missing out because your partner was doing things with another partner. But then when the tables were turned, and then it was kind of like your turn, and you got the JOMO, you got the joy of actually taking part, actually not the joy of missing out, but you actually got the joy of taking part in something, and then another partner got the sadness of missing out, then it's a zero-sum game. So one person is up, one person is down. And that is not abundant relating. That's like enclosure relating. That's that is just a kind of that is a kind of capitalizing value kind of relationship. And that's really not what the whole, you know, that's really not what relationship anarchy is meant to be about. Like, relationship anarchy is meant to be kind of like just win-wins, okay? It's about this kind of, well, I have a phrase, I do polyamory, you know, or relationship anarchy or abundant relating, but, you know, anyway, it's complex. And so the phrase that I use with my girlfriend is, you know, making polyamory work for me or making polyamory work for you. So, for example, my girlfriend and her husband like to go hiking and they like trees and all that stuff. I hate that. I absolutely despise it. Really hate the cows and the stiles and the pollen. And the pubs they always go on about being really great, but they're actually not because they stop serving lunch at 2 o'clock. You have to be there at that time, and you know, the beer's fine, and yeah, it's old, but you know, there are pubs in cities anyway. So in that kind of situation, I'm like, well, you two have a great time. I'm going to do something else, typically watching snooker, particularly this time of year. And so there's a win-win, right? But there's also another win-win because I'm able to increase the capacity of my girlfriend's capacity to act. I'm increasing my girlfriend's capacity to act by saying, "Well, I'm not going to be a drag on you going out. I'm planning something else. You have a really great time. You know, I hope you have a great time." It's a win-win-win because then my girlfriend and her husband, they have a great time. They feel energized. They've got out of the city. They do this thing they really enjoyed doing. You know, they get to have wonderful conversations, great memories. They're breathing in the air that they love so much. It's the same air, folks. It's the same air. Anyway, but, you know, they're having a great time. They're refreshed. And, of course, that benefits me because we're all part of this entanglement, okay? I don't want my girlfriend to be having a rubbish time because that affects me, even if I'm not directly part of it, because we're all part of this entanglement, okay? So I think that is, I think it's worthwhile thinking in this kind of way, if this kind of like, that any kind of relationship we get into, it doesn't matter what label we put on it, and I'm, you know, we get way too obsessed with labels in this kind of world. But, you know, any kind of relating we do should not only feel like a win-win, but it should feel like a win-win-win, really, ultimately. There might be, you know, there might be occasions where there might be, it might be trickier than, you know, a partner going on a hike. But still, it's all about trying to find the win-win-wins, okay? Which is not to say it's not hard, you know. So I've been doing various kinds of consensual non-monogamy relationships for quite a few years now, and I have often found it hard, and it took me more than a year to figure this out, dear listener. So, you know, it took me quite a long time. So I'm not here saying, you know, I've finally figured out the answers, this is the way to do it. But if somebody was giving me advice like this back then, I would have found it useful. But yeah, it can be really hard, and going through the, you know, feeling these feelings can be really tricky. And it got easier for me over time through practice, but also through trying to bring in a kind of abundant sense of relating for myself. Okay, which includes watching snooker, but is also quite a lot more than that as well. It's like really enjoying, you know, getting into theory podcasts, for example. Shout out to the theory podcasts that I listen to, and reading and seeing other friends more like intensely, and seeing my family, and, you know, having, you know, these different kinds of relationships that aren't just about, you know, sex, but also having sexual relationships with other people too. And it's like, this is the kind of the win-win-win kind of thing, the win-win-win relating for everyone involved in my entanglement. And again, it's not always easy, and it's sometimes really difficult, but we talk about it, we make the implicit explicit, and we're constantly trying to draw and redraw the entanglements to make it work for everybody. And that's really what we should all be aiming for, in my opinion, no matter what way of doing our relationship is, okay? And so in this way, again, I'm talking about, you know, how we might make relationships rhizomatic. Okay, and so by, and again, so rhizomatic is the complex root system that you get with bushes and grass, where one part of a root system is so connected and entangled up with another part of the root system, you can't disentangle them. They're all reliant on each other to produce the things we know of as a blade of grass, a bush, a hop, which is used to make beer, hashtag beer. So let's... I'm saying here that, you know, thinking rhizomatically about this way of relating does also open up the possibilities of these, this kind of like win-win-win kind of way of doing relating. I think perhaps we also need to question this kind of binary that seems to be here about the joy of missing out, the fear of missing out, or joy of missing out, or SOMO, the sadness of missing out. Because that also, it kind of implies that there is another binary, but kind of beneath that, of that doing the thing, doing the important event, equals good. Not doing the thing, not doing the important event, equals bad. Okay? So then we kind of, we reify this idea of doing the thing is always the right, the good thing to do. And actually, that's not always true. But also, I don't think it's a very helpful way of thinking about things. And because there are lots of things that, doing the thing might be, you know, might be awful, doing the thing, you know, doing the important thing might be rubbish, boring, disappointing, a bit of an anticlimax actually, or tough, or really hard, like draining emotionally or physically, financially, or it might be something else. It might just be, you know, a bit meh, there are. So I think it's really important that we remember that doing the thing and doing the event involves the possibility that I might not be very good. But also, we like not doing a thing, having, like, for example, having quiet time or just chilling out or not really doing anything and resting, relaxing, looking after ourselves, being kind of resourcing ourselves, and really taking care of things and paying attention to things and being slow and attentive. You know, these are really important things. And so, you know, if the societal story around this and the kind of the construct around this is, you know, that the people who are having the best time are the ones who are, you know, they're on a, what are they doing? They're on like a boat, aren't they? Or that they're on a boat and they're or on a pier. And they're diving into some water. They've been on a hike and they're on a pier or a boat. And they're diving into a lake or something, aren't they? Or the sea. They've been at the beach and they're at the sea. And they're lying around in their swimwear and they're smiling. And they've got sunglasses on and their friends are around. And they're all saying things like, yay, or ooh, way, this is great. And, you know, I look at all these pictures of everyone on the dating apps and I think, oh, that looks like all, that looks like my kind of idea of hell. Like, this is terrible. You know, where are the pictures of people on the dating apps just kind of, you know, sitting around in their pants watching snooker? What, in fact, why have I not done this? So this is just to say that we put the emphasis on doing the thing as the sign that you are successful, the sign that you are in a good relationship, the doing the thing. But actually, relationships are just as much sitting down, watching repeats of Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares, eating popcorn, as they are getting dressed up or going to a beach and jumping in the water and, you know, yelling. Right, so, right. Next, I've got notes here, so I'm sorry if this is rambly, but, you know, I always say that. I'm not sorry this is rambly, but I'm enjoying it. I hope you're enjoying it. I will maybe cut some of this down, but also I might not. Next, do we have to experience everything our partner feels? Like, is being in a relationship, does that mean that we have to actually experience what they're doing, like in the kind of Yoko and John way? So, you know, when Yoko Ono and John Lennon got together So Yoko Ono is a really successful artist, one of the pioneers of conceptual art and kind of minimalist art, really important kind of artist. And then there was John Lennon. And they were in the Beatles, John Lennon was in the Beatles. But then when Yoko Ono and John Lennon were in a relationship, Yoko would come to all the recording sessions. I think this is apocryphal now, and I've watched the Beatles documentary because I am actually a Beatles fan. I'm just being silly by pretending at John Lennon, by diminishing John Lennon, but, you know. Anyway, in that documentary, it's clear that actually it wasn't really like that. But Yoko was there all the time. And what Yoko and John would say about it is, you know, other couples, their partner would come home and they would say, you know, how was your day, dear? And they would tell them the story about their day. And that they don't have to do that because they spend every minute of their day and night together. So they experience everything together. They became, it was literally like two become one kind of thing. Okay, to quote the Spice Girls. So, but do you want to be in a relationship like that? Like, do you want to, like, experience everything your partner's experiencing? Do you want to experience everything your partner's experiencing with their other partners too? Like, do you have to kind of be around in that way? And so this is just a useful way of thinking about this, I think. I know that's an expression I keep using, but I think a useful way of thinking about this is Venn diagrams, which is a very straightforward way of thinking about relationships. And again, this comes from our zine that Meg, John and I did, Make Your Own Relationship User Guide. It's, well, how much do we want to overlap? Like, you know, which bits, you know, if you think of yourself as two circles or, you know, a series of circles which overlap, like, how much do we want to do that? I actually think we might be better off thinking about, instead of circles now, I think we would be better drawing a kind of a root system, but it's only because I'm a bit obsessed with it. I don't think we're circles. I think we're open-ended lines on a map. But anyway, but you know, how much do we want to, we could talk about entanglements even, like, how much do we want to, like, be entangled? Like, do you want like an entanglement to map directly on top of somebody else's entanglement, or do you want your entanglement to have different fonts, different kind of movements? Which also is like a key reminder that this way of doing relationships is not just about having different romantic or sexual partners. Like, I do have a bit of a, if I go on a date with somebody who does polyamory, and they say this partner this, this partner this, this partner this, partner this, and they're not mentioned their friends or their relationship with themselves or work or organizing or organizations or family or pets or a relationship to anything other than their sexual or romantic partners, I'm like, well, I often think they might not be a person for me. But I don't know, I'm trying not to be closed-minded about these things, but I think it's really useful just to remember that we have different kinds of relationships, different ways of doing relating. So we don't have to experience all of these things. And so, and there's always a corollary of this. There's always the other side of this. So you might not necessarily want to experience everything that your partner experiences, and your partner doesn't necessarily want to experience everything you experience. Like, you want to be separate disentanglements to an extent, perhaps. So always think about, always think about the other side of this too, because I think that is a helpful way of thinking about this. It's not a it's rather than just thinking of yourself as in a relationship where this relationship is being done to you, and the fear of, or the joy of, or the sadness of missing out is something that's happening to you. Instead, think about it as being this kind of this affective kind of swinging door, which we're about to get to, folks, which has a both sidesness to it. That the same door is operating two things. That there is always something behind and before, and that we're kind of questioning. There's always kind of like a power going both ways and all other ways going on around these kinds of things, rather than it just being happening to you. I think that's important. And if you don't really feel like you have that, if you're in a romantic relationship and you're feeling like this is being done to you, then I would suggest that, you know, if that was happening in a friendship, would that be okay? Like, if you were constantly feeling like this relationship was being done to you, rather than you being invited to see what emerges between you, to play table tennis with each other, not to see who wins at table tennis or who's better at table tennis, but to see how much fun it is, how much fun can possibly be had playing table tennis. So it's kind of you both versus table tennis, and seeing how much fun and memories and joy you can get out of it, rather than one person batting a ball over to the other, and, you know, that kind of interplay like that, that kind of interaction like that, instead where... anyway, sorry, I was about to go down a theory rabbit hole again. So as I've been kind of indicating, like, there, I think another useful way of thinking about this, again, I talked about this, and I think in the last episode, is Duchamp's door. So Duchamp's door, again, is when Duchamp moved into his flat in early 20th century in Paris. He had a joiner fit a door which closed, which was the door which closed the kitchen door and opened the bathroom door simultaneously. One door doing two things. So when you close the kitchen door, the bathroom door opens. When you close the bathroom door, the kitchen door opens. And so it's useful to remember that there is always the one door is doing two things. Okay, the one door is opening up possibilities in both directions. Okay, so it's not one door closes and another door opens. This swinging motion of this door is doing two things. It's a win-win door. It's the win-win door. Okay, and so if, say, you get into a future relationship and your partner's doing something important with somebody else, what does that do for you? What does it do? What does it give? What does it open up the possibilities for? How can you think of that door that closes the kitchen door as being beneficial for you to go to the bathroom, have a nice bath, get the candles out, get, have a tremendous poo or something, or, or a good bath, probably a good bath. And then afterwards you rub yourself down, you rub some oils into you or something. You really enjoy being in your body and you're being slow and you've got Radio 3 on and you're just kind of like feeling a bit sexy and kind of, you know, like feeling really in my body, and this is really nice and I'm enjoying the music and the smells and the slowness and the time, and no one else is really enjoying this as much as I am at the moment. You know, this is a wonderful thing. Or the door closes to the bathroom and the kitchen opens, and then you've got some tinned cannellini beans and there's some anchovies in the fridge, and you got some garlic and some chili and you a little bit of tomato left over, and you decide to make yourself a puttanesca with a cannellini beans instead of pasta, and it's really good. That's a great recipe, by the way, folks. You should try that. So it's that thing of, this is the other way of thinking about win-wins. And so, yes, maybe the door might swing in a way that you didn't want it to swing, but what does that do? Okay, what does that do for you? And so in that way, you can think of, well, it gives me this power to act, this kind of these possibilities for me to become free within this relationship, and for my entangledness to go out into the world and to entangle with other things, entangle with other people, other relations, other loves. And then just lastly, just a bit of kind of like advice, like actual kind of closing advice. So let's say you're in a situation where you're feeling a bit of SOMO, you're feeling a bit of sad that you're missing out. What would be the very, very first sign that things were starting to move in a more JOMO direction, like a joy of missing out? What might be the very first sign that you might see just the smallest possibility of things becoming a little bit more joyful? If you're feeling, let's say 10 is you experience joy of missing out, where there's no sadness whatsoever, you just feel like, wow, this is great, I can get to do this, this and this and this, bang, I love it when my partner's doing things with somebody else, because that means I get to do this with other people, or for me, this is wonderful. Let's say that's a 10. You couldn't be more happy, couldn't be more joyful at missing out on an important event. And 0 is the opposite. What number are you at that moment? How come you're not at one number below that? So let's say you're at a 3. And how come you're not at a 2? Okay, so write down all the things that put you, or say out loud, all of the things that put you at a 3 and not a 2. And then think, okay, well, if that number got 1 point higher, what would be the very first thing I noticed? So let's say you went from a 3 to a 4 on the joy of missing out scale to sadness of missing out scale, and things got a little bit more joyful. What would be the very first thing you notice? What might it be? You know, might it be running a bath? Might it be opening a tin? Might it be texting a friend? Might it be switching, you know, see if there's snooker on at the moment? If you're switching on the TV at the moment over the course of the next 2 weeks, there will be snooker on, okay? It's the best time of the year. You know, what's the very first sign you're going from a 3 to a 4, or even from a 3 to a 3.5? What else? What else might you notice? What else? Then what might happen if you go from a 4 to a 5? Or a 5 to a 6. And think about this in terms of what I was saying earlier about affects, like how our body's affected, what happens to our body when we're feeling a feeling, what emotional state might that lead to, what thoughts might we have around that, how we might make sense of this, or how we might start to feel like think creatively, and then what actions we might take, and how we might that might affect us and the world, and us in the world, and how that circle might keep moving. What else might happen? What else might happen? And they could be tiny, tiny things, tiniest of tiny things that might tell you that you are feeling that little bit more joyful. Okay. And if you do this as a practice over the course of a few days, weeks, months, I promise you, well, okay, there is an 80% chance that you'll get to a point of feeling JOMO much more quickly. Okay. Because this, and what I'm talking about here, is like a solution-focused activity. So from the solution-focused brief therapy, which is an incredibly effective, very quick, and not very profit-making for therapists, way of doing therapy that I've been trained in, in most cases, they do start to have a beneficial effect over the course of a few months. Just try to just notice the very first sign of something becoming that little bit more joyful or a little bit less sad. And what do you notice? Because then ultimately as well, this is also a kind of, this is like a kind of a self-care, a self-reflexive kind of activity. And this is like doing the work. And we can't rely on our partners or our or other people to do this for us. We do have to do this, but we do that in relation to everybody else. We're not just kind of these shut off individual tiles that have to do the work on ourselves, because ourselves is always in relation to everyone else. But if we're not doing any of this ourselves, and we're always relying on other people preventing us from feeling a feeling that we might not want to feel, that's going to overall become a Spinozan sad way of doing relationships. If we're asking our partners to act in a way where we are prevented from feeling a feeling, or that because we are so afraid of feeling a feeling and can't deal with a feeling, that our partners feel that they can't do things, then overall, that's decreasing everybody's capacity to act. And that is creating a sadness, a sadder relationship. Okay? So as part of the process of being in joyful relationships, of having relationships where there is an increased capacity to act, a more abundant way of doing love, relationships, intimacy, dating, there is also a responsibility on ourselves to try to understand how we feel our feelings, how we feel emotions, how we go through, how we think about that, and the actions that we take that then might affect us, that might help us start feeling that tiny little bit better. And dear reader who sent this in, if you would like a free coaching session about this, or however many coaching sessions you want, it might only need one or two sessions, let me know, drop me an email. And dear listener, if you would also like a coaching session, hit me up, send me an email, and we can book that in. More information about that at my website, justinhancock.co.uk. I think I'm charging like £45 for one session. Most people only want one session or two sessions, there's a good chance it'll work for anything that you might want to work on. But also, dear listener, there's loads more advice and loads more kind of resources at the Patreon, behind the Patreon wall, patreon.com/culturesexrelationships. That's £1 a month, and it helps to keep the show on the road, and helps me to, you know, pay myself. So, thank you so much for switching on and pressing play and being part of Culture Sex Relationships today. And I'll be back with another one. We'll be back with another one soon. Okay, bye.